Okay, I have about 15 minutes for this part, so I'm sure we're not going to be able to discuss all parts of the recommended use policy thoroughly in that amount of time. But first of all, has anybody in the room read the recommended use policy yet? Okay. the recommended use policy is on the wiki. You should definitely read it. It's been sent out to mailing groups, it's been posted, and it's on the track for becoming the Genie policy, the first Genie policy for how we'll use Genie resources. We discussed this in our last working group meeting, and you can look at the minutes, but basically suggestions were made that we should use as much as we could from what Planet Lab had already found in being in this same world, that we should keep the security policy as small as we can and only ask for the things that we really think we need to say in the security policy. And also that obviously it needed to come back to the working group and be discussed and get feedback. So that's what we're trying to do now. We need to adopt a recommended use policy because we are going into having operational projects that are Genie projects. So there's a question.
How do you define illegal here, and do the users have enough understanding of the jurisdiction in which their processes are running to understand what illegal is in the context of not where they are, but where their machine is?
Okay, so the policy does not define illegal.
Yeah.
So we're getting a little bit ahead here. It's okay, I just want to explain for the people who are only listening to audio that the first screen is up already that says we don't do anything illegal on Genie. So just to finish the context, with what happens in this working group, we're going to decide whether to continue with the policy, accept it, reject it, or modify it. So pay attention, because at the end we're going to ask you what you want to do. Okay, so let me put this back. Just to make it a little easier, these are my highly biased things that I extracted from the policy to talk about in the meeting. I think I got all the important points, but you definitely should read it yourself and see if you agree. Okay, James.
Sorry, I have not read this before.
Go ahead.
And I don't know, I'm sure you've thought of this, but does not allow illegal activities is quite loaded.
Yes,
illegal
it is.
Where?
Yes. Yep.
In fact, there was some other context where there's just a discussion about this, and a blanket state like that meant basically you could do nothing because they're. Sorry. I was just in a discussion in another context where a statement, generic statement, does not allow illegal activities was interpreted as meaning literally do nothing because it was international. And if you, China and third world nations, you can't do anything. So that might be.
So that particular piece is in the Planet Lab policy already, and clearly Planet Lab is doing things. But it's a valid comment. Okay, so the other thing that's on the slide, I'll just say, is that there are local policies, and Karen brought this up before, and several of you know from doing operations and dealing with CIOs and IT groups, those local policies exist, and Genie needs to be aware that they exist, whatever the Genie policies are going to combine with those local policies for campuses, for transit networks, for regional networks, and that's something that we're going to have to be cognizant of. So this overview paragraph is the key thing that says why there's a policy and what you have to know about it if you're going to be on Genie. In addition to that, there's some guidelines, and this part of the guidelines talks about what researchers and infrastructure providers in particular have to do. So if you're in this room and you're running a project, that means you. So if this is an issue for you, now's the time to speak. You can't violate knowingly any of the local acceptable use policies. The obvious question is, how do you know what they are? Right now, you can't go to the Genie website and find that out. You have to debug your software and your hardware before you put it on Genie. Where do you do that? How do you do that? What if your software only works at scale? You guys are going to have to figure that out. But you don't take your stuff and put it on Genie for the first time and hope that you don't hurt anybody. You're not allowed to hurt anybody outside in other infrastructures. And hurt, I know, is a squishy term here. That's my term. It's not what it says in the policy. There was a debate at the last working group session, like, what does it mean to be other infrastructure? And a useful definition that Ted Faber brought up was anything that's outside your slice. So you can do whatever you want to destroy your own slice, but you can't do anything bad to anybody else. If you're providing infrastructure, maybe you're a regional network and you're providing some transit, does that mean that, you know, you're making sure that no one can do anything to hurt any other part of your transit? Well, of course you're going to, but is it policy that you have to do that? James?
Bad, not including congestion. I mean, obviously so traffic affects others, so you have to be
right.
A little careful.
So if
that
I'm
one.
A local site and I think congestion is hurting me, that's going to be interpreted as bad. And then there's the obvious follow-on question of, well, how do you find out that somebody thinks you're doing something bad and how do you hear about it? And if there is a problem, you as a participant are going to be required to help investigate and address it. Again, this is something that's already done in Planet Lab, and if you're on the mailing list, you see all the time requests to people to investigate something that was reported as a problem by a campus. And people seem to be fairly cooperative about it in Planet Lab, but it's another thing that you have to do, another resource and time that you have to spend on your project that you may not have been thinking about in advance. In addition, there's some things that end users have to worry about and researchers together. Because of the fact that Genie is explicitly allowing researchers to run services and to let people opt into their experiments. And this policy says that the researchers are responsible for making sure their opt-in users follow the Genie policy. And since the Genie policy says also be aware of the local acceptable use policies, that's a pretty big chunk of things for a researcher to bite off. Can you just say what project you are? I can't read you.
I'm from OSU and part of the Kansai project. So is this just a list of guidelines, or is this a legal document? Like, is this a legal framework? So especially like things like not hurting the other users. So it's one thing to intentionally do that, and the other thing is to be not aware of that you're doing that, right? So if I am a Genie user, am I accepting those as a legal condition or just a guideline?
So I wish that our legal advisor was in the room now, but he's not. So this is not a legal document in the sense that it was drawn up by a lawyer or anything like that. However, it is a policy, and the fact that it exists, you know, could be relevant when something legal happens on Genie, right? So as far as how I'm addressing it, we're trying to come up with a policy that's agreed to by the people who are participating in Genie, and there are certain things that the lawyers, you know, would like to be in that policy. And so it can be used legally, but it's not trying to be a legal document.
So is the question, are you worried about people not using because the terms are too onerous? Have you opened any software box in the last 10 years? Seriously, or do you have a cell phone? I mean, any of those you blindly check off on terms that are so onerous, if you read them, you wouldn't want to do it. And this is really no different.
But I keep that accept button, I at least know that I'm, you know, planning on those things, right? So is that...
So I guess to get to your real question, which is, well, what if I didn't mean to hurt somebody and I did? If somebody notices that they're hurt, and you didn't mean to, you still have to address it. You still have to help look into it and address it. And, you know, it doesn't mean we're going to kick you off if you didn't mean to do it, but it does mean you have a responsibility to help Genie deal with it.
Yeah, if you read the details in the document, it has words about intentionally intending to do something. Of course, once you've been notified that your project is damaging someone, not turning it off is intentionally continuing to do what you were doing.
Yep. There's no Genie privacy guarantees right now. I don't know if there ever will be, but right now there aren't. So this is just explicitly telling everybody that. There's no reliability guarantees either. We can take anything down anytime we want to. I don't think anybody in the room will actually disagree with that, but it could be an issue for some of these users we've brought up as example who might be trying to sell services or run things on Genie that have users who are going to be really annoyed if it starts to disappear. So what if somebody violates the recommended use policy? What happens? If you've looked at some of the OMIS use cases, then you have an idea what happens, which is we're going to have some people who are responsible for operations even before we have an official operations group or tools or data sharing or anything like that. Because at some point, if there's a problem with Genie, someone's going to call on the phone and say, what the heck are you guys thinking about? What are you doing? And they might start by just contacting the project people directly, and as Steve brought up, the GPO might not even know. But eventually the GPO is gonna find out. Mike will get involved, or I'll get involved. And what we'd like to say is that when we notice that there's a problem, i.e. someone calls in and says they have a problem with, say, somebody using too much bandwidth on a campus, we're going to try and contact the people who are involved in that slice or that experiment or that infrastructure. But if it's necessary, we're going to take action even without being able to notify them. Again, this is a common thing that's also done in Planet Lab and lots of other test beds, but we're just being explicit about saying here that it's going to happen. And of course, we need to define who the operations people are. The first step, like Steve said, is just having a list of who the contacts are, making that easy for people to find and access, and making sure that it stays up to date. And that'll change with the different spirals. So comments, questions, objections, rants? We have about 5 minutes for rents? So how many people think that they could operate their projects if this policy was in effect starting tomorrow? If you sent me your contacts tonight, would you be able to continue working under this kind of a policy and these kind of guidelines? Not too bad? Yes? Can you go to the mic? Sorry,
again from GMOC. I have a question on the illegal part. Reiterating on the illegal question, the problem with that statement is that they don't even give you jurisdiction. Is it illegal for you, for the place?
He still can't hear. Just take the microphone
okay.
Now, please.
So on the illegal part, I think it's a very strong statement that should be rethought of, because illegal, you mean illegal as me where I'm staying, illegal where my host is staying, illegal mm-hmm. where the data is being downloaded, mm-hmm. illegal for what? Mm-hmm. And I think that's a too much a blank statement. It had worked for Planet Lab, but I think it will not work for Genie.
Because
Planet Lab is a much smaller scale than what Genie is going to be, and our challenges will be much larger. So things will happen. We're expected to have huge volumes of data, mm-hmm. and let's say I publish some document that is accessible via Genie that is legal in the U.S., and mm-hmm. somebody from China gets it, and they say it's a travel to China, and I have done something illegal. Now, for them, what should Genie do? Take my whole slice down because I violated the use policy?
That's a good question. Does that mean you think Planet Lab doesn't There's nobody from China using Planet Lab now?
No, they have not. They have not bothered to enforce the policy.
Okay. So are you suggesting that the statement about not doing things illegal be taken out, or
yes,
that a definition be added?
Be taken out or changed by something else.
Uh-huh. Other people's opinion?
I think this is the thing I brought up initially. If you just say illegal, it's how you interpret it. And
yep,
somehow I suspect that that statement is too broad, and there's going to be need some qualification. Maybe that's what you're going to address.
So just to be clear, so you're suggesting that a definition be added?
Yeah, I don't think it should be taken out, but I think probably it warrants qualification, like in the jurisdiction of the user. I don't know. I'm not a lawyer, but I suspect that statement as it stands is probably not clear enough.
Can you put up the statement?
Oh, sure. Sorry.
So do you think that whether the statement is in there or not changes whether it's actually legal or not? Do you think it changes whether does it make you more or less responsible for whether something illegal is taking place on the network? I think it creates sort of a responsibility to do some due diligence to make sure that as far as you understand, there aren't illegal things going on in the network. But I'm not a lawyer.
So I have to have the whole world, I have to know every law in every country, every jurisdiction?
Doesn't your ISP make you agree to a similar statement?
I truly do. One of the issues is it's very easy for anybody to make a complaint that this slice should be taken down because it's doing something illegal somewhere, and that could cause problems.
So that actually might be, just for the record, Luke said that it makes it very easy for people to complain that somebody's doing something illegal on a slice and for you to take it down. And actually, that might be the desirable outcome, right? Because I think what this does is this puts the ability for an operator to an owner of resources to kill something because they believe that there's something illegal going on with there, and so it may be if you flip it around that you may actually may be limited in your ability to kill things if you think there's something illegal going there if you didn't have this policy. I mean, this policy actually sort of helps you.
So, I'm not a lawyer, obviously.
Yeah, but we're not trying to be.
But none of this changes the legality of anything. The reason you sign the document every time you go skiing saying you understand you may die is so that they can document that you have understood the terms, which is what this would be. But I do agree that if you just simply say, can't do any illegal activities, then somebody else is going to say this isn't legal in China or Saudi Arabia. I don't think we want to open ourselves to that.
So it does seem that we have an incredible lack of lawyers here when we're discussing it. Maybe that's not. Okay, so it does seem like we have an incredible lack of lawyers here, and maybe that's incorrect, but are there any lawyers in the room right now? Okay.
Jeannie has one.
Okay, so zero hands for the record. And not that I'm suggesting that we need more lawyers, but I think that ultimately this is going to be, this is going to, end up in the hands of a lawyer who's, and they're going to use this and interpret it as lawyers do, and that we can have this discussion as much as we want, but ultimately if this isn't really driven by lawyers, then we're going to get it wrong, and they're going to interpret it differently from how we meant it. So, we may end up with this nice gentleman's agreement, but we should be very careful what that really means in a legal sense.
Yeah, I totally agree. And actually, the one lawyer that Jeannie has is consulting. But you know how it is with lawyers. That's one lawyer's opinion.
Yeah, I just want to underscore that the prospect that this is supposed to be a global facility, right? And
yes,
so you will have this international issue,
yes,
that you have to deal with, that the laws are different. And
so how do you deal with it?
Well,
do you have a policy
that says nothing illegal in Washington? We are crossing that divide now. The other question is how do you deal with it once you've decided that you do want to to remove a slice that's misbehaving. In some sections, you know, one local domain, you know, the owner may say that's either breaking something or it's illegal. I want to kill that, but that may not predicate killing the whole slice.
Yes, that's
right,
true.
For either you know, legal administrative reasons or for just privacy reasons. Right.
Right? If you've got 20 campuses in an experiment, you might just need to get rid of one.
That's right. Yep. So we need to make sure that you know, one owner has the visibility to see what's happening with their resources right, in that slice, but maybe not necessarily visibility to everything that's happening in that slice.
Yep. I'm sorry, we don't have time for your comment.
Yeah, these are not technically comments, so I think I can squeak by.
But. No, I'm just kidding.
So I'd like to just kind of report on a parallel thread that's been going on, and Larry Peterson has been one of the people with Helen Nissenbaum kind of leading that charge, which is to say, within the U.S., you know, maybe a way to approach this is to have kind of a code of best practices for researchers that is a voluntary code, probably housed in some professional organization, so that, you know, these are good practices for what you can do in the slice. And then a relatively uniform set of agreements across CIOs and so on, things that join Genie with a kind of an if-then statement. If people adhere to the code of best practices, then, you know, they will not be arbitrarily shut down. And so that is a line of thought that's going on. A second parallel line of thought is actually folks from the UC, Berkeley Law School and Harvard Law School who have pointed out that regulations in this area can be changed. So national regulations are not fixed. We if we decide what we like, it is possible to change the regulations. That would be very handy because, as I understand it, the wiretapping laws in each of the states is different. And so even within the U.S., you have 50 different sets of wiretapping laws that you have to worry about.
Yep.
And the third and final point of this is, I think the international part is a, you know, the technical parts of international federation are not so hard. The parts about laws, privacy, and so on are extremely difficult, and that's why we should start now, as it's going to take a long, long time to get that straight.
Thank you. Okay. Yep. Okay. Okay, so I think I heard the rough consensus of people in the room is the policy sounds okay. We should look at the restriction about illegal and fine-tune it a bit. Definitely have at least one and hopefully more lawyers take a look at it. And then resend it out to the mailing list. Yeah, what are we going to do once we agree on this one? Yeah, that's a whole nother working group meeting on its own. Yeah. Okay, so Mike and I will take care of following up on those action items, and please do respond to the mailing list and do read through the whole text. Thanks. I get my computer back.
So while you're setting up, I just want to point out that it might be, somebody else already sort of suggested this, it might be more successful if we had sort of a the equivalent of a click-through agreement to the Genie license. So you're not going to get lunch until you agree to moving forward on the Genie use policy. So, you know, everybody raise your hand, you know, or we'll wait here, you know.
I will try to avoid any talk of that involves lawyers. So my name is John Paul Herron. I work at the Global NOC at Indiana University. We run the networks most of you probably think are uninteresting. So we're the NOC for Internet 2 and NLR and several others, as well as our work here for GMOC. So I have four topics here, and the speed I go through these depends on this the questions I get. Since I only have 30 minutes here, if you have something to bring it up when I'm talking about it, so I can get through everything. I'm going to start talk a little bit about, do a quick review of what our project is trying to accomplish in Spiral 1. Already talked about that at the last GEC and lots of individual conversations, so I'm not going to spend much time on that unless there are questions. The main two topics that I'll discuss will be an overview of our operational dataset document. We'll go over that in some detail, and that may generate some discussion and some input. Then I'll talk about some of the progress we've made in talking about this document and talking about our project generally with all the other projects. Because our project isn't part of a control framework, a cluster, we talk a lot with all of the clusters. So this will talk about some of the things we've found in our discussions with everybody. And then if there's time, I'll introduce real briefly some of the things that we started doing, talking about the data format for sharing operational data. So as a quick review of our Spiral 1 goals, we have four basic goals. First, we're trying to investigate the scope and methods of operational data sharing among all the Genie projects. This means what kind of operational data is useful to share among us, among the Genie projects, how to share it, what subject to look at in terms of operational data. Do we want to think about aggregates or components or slices? Using that, our goal is to start collecting and sharing that data. This includes not just getting data from all the projects and sharing it among the projects, but also potentially sharing it between Genie and federated other networks, internationals in particular. Three and four here are the main Spiral 1 deliverables, if you want to put it in those terms. So three is putting together some sort of Genie-wide view of operations. So let's look at Genie overall and see what's up and what's down and how much traffic's going across it and what the state of Genie is as a whole, both for audiences that are operating elements of Genie as well as the research audience who may be interested in getting information about what's going on during their experiment. And then four is starting to look at the emergency shutdown, emergency stop functionality, figuring out how much of that needs to be coordinated across Genie and how much of that really belongs down in the clusters. So there are four goals and four phases, I guess, to go along with it. So the way we break it down is basically start out deciding what data we want to get. This is the discussion I'll spend most of my time on here today. What's the minimum set of data that we want to collect from all the projects in order to give the most basic operational functions? Second, once we know what we want, we need to know how to get it. What's the best format and protocol for gathering all that data from all the projects? And then once we know what to get and how to get it, then we need to start looking at what to do with it once we got it. So to start off, we're looking at this operational view, which is probably going to take the form of a bunch of maps and graphs that everybody's used to seeing. We plan to have something along those lines to demonstrate it by GEC5.
Let me ask a quick question. So it strikes me, I'm actually very much in favor of first figuring out what I want to get, or just figuring out stuff that would be useful generally, but most people actually think about the problem the other way around and say, well, what is it I'm trying, what problems am I trying to solve, and therefore what kind of data do I need to collect?
Right, and that's actually, that it looks opposite in the phasing, but that is the approach.
My reaction to that is, often it's the case that we collect data because there is some problem we're trying to solve or something we're trying to learn,
yeah.
But in fact it turns out that data is useful for many other problems. I mean, packet traces,
yes.
You can do a lot of things with, but
yeah.
People usually do packet traces to solve a problem initially,
yeah.
And then it would be great if other people could use it for other things.
Sure.
Or,
yeah, and I think it, looking beyond Spiral 1,
yeah.
I guess,
yeah.
You know, we've looked at these couple of basic functions that we want to get and say what data would give those, and then move from there to say what else could we do with that data or what other data would give us some new functionality. So, okay, so we've produced this document, this operational data set document, to answer this what data to get question. We distributed it pretty broadly across all the Genie projects for further input and made some modifications based on the input we've received. This document is basically two sections. One describes mostly what I just talked about, which is what we want to do with the data, which gives some context as to what data we want to get. And then there's a section that breaks down the operational data into three or five basic categories, depending on how you count your categories, and gives examples of each type, and most importantly, probably for discussion here today, a proposed minimum set of each kind of data that we're looking to get about each project. This says from each project, but that's probably not a good term. We're interested in getting this data about each project. The way we get it may not be directly from the project. It may be through a control framework. So, if the approach here is to produce something like this at the end, obviously it's not going to be this. This is just for illustration purposes. it doesn't even show weather radar on there. So if we want to end up producing something like this on a Genie-wide scale, and obviously there's lots of maps that would be needed, not one, and it'd be way more complicated than this. But if we want to produce something like this, what are the general types of data that we're interested in gathering to put it together? So the first thing that you're interested in is getting topology. And the topology goes in and gives you, you know, where the lines connect, where the circles and squares go, how many of them there are, and that kind of data. So that's the first category of data that I'll talk about. Second is some general status, up, down, and not quite up, not quite down kinds of status. And this is one of those categories that could either be one or two, depending on whether you count operational status and administrative status as separate or not. I'll get into that in a minute. So that colors everything. And then the last set of data is more of the utilization measures, how much traffic there is, and how many errors there are, all of those kinds of counters that go in to provide the rest of the fanciness.
Question, Jean-Paul, about this?
Yes.
So when you think about, at this level, I've got no comments, but if you drill down into a particular network, wireless networks have, topology isn't sort of the only way that you talk about connectivity, right? So, I mean, there's wireline that connects stuff, but there's also sort of the range and the spectrum issues.
Right.
And I'm not sure if you want to, if that's a special category. It's sort of a variant of topology, but you might want to think about it.
Most of what we've described as topology should be generic enough that it would fit there. You know, maybe the concept of links doesn't apply quite as clearly in that case. And there is a whole separate section of data that we're interested in getting, which is special data that's specific to a particular type of element.
And are you going to talk about sort of how far down a view you want to be able to present?
Yes.
Okay.
I think.
Okay, John. I've got the classic international question now.
Yes. Right?
Why do you bound it at that topology? I mean, if as we start bringing in these other resources from other places around the world, that's not the only topology you want to look at.
Well, that's
right. So how do you define that? What's your criteria for saying this is the topology I want to look at? There's another issue here, but let's just leave it at that for the moment.
Okay. Well, so topology is everything within Genie from my perspective. So whether that's in the U.S. or not is a separate issue. That has more to do with my illustration here than anything. There's a separate topic there, which is how do you share operational data between Genie and other Genie-ish things or other not Genie-ish things that might exist elsewhere, and how do you present that in sort of a unified way.
Yeah, and the other point was just that, you know, particularly on this second spiral call, there was a request for resources that may not be actually considered traditional network resources,
mm-hmm.
storage facilities, you know, data center facilities. How would you represent that in terms of if I want to get a Genie view?
Yeah.
You know, how do I see that?
There's definitely a visualization. There's a lot of visualization challenges. I'll say that. All right, so each type of data, here's the meat of this. So the proposed minimum topology, for instance. This is mostly about substrate, and it's broken down into a couple of areas. First, I guess, at a component level, we want to know who's in charge of a component, what aggregate that component's related to, and where it is. This is sort of what I would consider baseline information about a component. Next would be, what are the interfaces of that component? What are the links relationship to those interfaces in order to understand the relationship between the components? And what other information is there about the links, about how big to make those lines?
What about connectivity to other networks, like the internet?
Oh, yeah. Well, so the question is...
Or ESnet or Starlight or Canary.
Right. So... there's a DMARC issue there, which is where what is the component from the Genie perspective in that area. So I think that's more of an open question to decide, right?
But I'm just saying that if you've got a component that is sort of on a Genie network, but yeah. It also has an interface to something that is not on the Genie network, that the existence of that interface might be something that you would want to show in
sure.
the topology.
Yeah, right. And showing non-Genie things some way is important to gather. Obviously, if we stick with this minimum, you get the interface data, you get the link, but what's on the other end of that link is outside Genie, but it's still important to denote. So, like I said, most of this is substrate. There are a couple of what I would consider pretty basic slice topology things, which is what slivers are within a given component at a given time, and whose slivers are they? So status information, this is your basic up-down impaired. Everyone should be used to seeing. Optionally, there, you might want to provide more detail about why something's up or down or impaired, but that's not part of what we're considering minimally needed right now. And as I mentioned, there are two statuses here. One is the operational status, what is actually up and down right now, and the second is administrative status, what's intended to be up or down right now. In an environment like Genie, you can't just assume that everything is intended to be up at any given point. So actually, the relation between administrative status and operational status is what's most important, not just what's down, but what's supposed to be up but isn't.
So maybe you just answered that, but so a little finer grain than just red, yellow, green.
Yes.
Because we've already got, I think... I keep hoping not to add more categories. We got like about 8 of them in the table, including temporarily down once it's been up and all that
yeah,
stuff.
Well, yeah, well, you know, we went over a lot of the ways that you might categorize this, and that's one of the things that we came up with. And we kind of decided a good starting place is to keep it small until you need to add categories or use these categories and add additional detail that would say, yes, this is down, or yes, this is impaired, but, you know, it's temporary.
Yeah, if it's not too onerous, having early agreements so that we're all talking this, you know, more or less the same language would be
yes.
a good thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, certainly there's a fuzzy area between down and impaired, for instance, or even up and impaired. So, our proposed minimum here for both those categories, operational, administrative, is just at a component level or an aggregate level, depending on what's important to your particular project. Is it up or down or impaired? And the same for links. So some in some places, I don't think knowing that components X, Y, and Z are each up or down is as important if you're not providing those components separately to Genie. You might just want to say this aggregate has two components within it that are up and one that is down. The third general category is, yes?
So one Really, if you go back to the previous slide, the level of information that you need in terms of component aggregate status really depends upon the resources that you're exporting to the clearinghouse. So at whatever granularity.
Yes. Whatever is interesting from a resource specification level is also interesting from an operational perspective. Yeah.
It might even be part of the RSpec or something.
Sure.
That's one.
So utilization condition measures, these are two different kinds of measures that are similar in many ways, but have different operational impact, I guess. So a utilization measure is just your basic counters of whatever the kind of box it is, whether that be packets per second, bits per second. You know, there might be other kinds of measures for other different kinds of devices out there. And component CPU, which is probably the most basic utilization measure on a component. For condition measures, we're really looking at error counters and packet drops. These are a type of utilization, I guess, that has some meaning operationally. So you might want eventually to say that if errors are non-zero, that it you should really consider it impaired, for instance. And that's the last slide I've got on the actual data set document, if anybody has any further comments on that.
So for impaired, I guess right now it's just sort of by example, but we are doing work in resilience where we actually need, you have to define the difference between down, impaired, and operational, and usually this, well, there are actually two dimensions. There's a network operations perspective that says whether the networking is operating as expected, and there's a service dimension which says whether or not you're meeting the expected service requirements of the user. And this is actually really standard telecom stuff, so all the ATIS documents go into depth about this kind of stuff. So I assume you rely on some of that.
Yeah, I mean, we're trying to stay out of getting too specific at this point, but...
Well, I'm not suggesting that it get, again, too onerous, but... If you're going to have these three bits of the spectrum, at some point, even if it's the user needs to define what they consider impaired operation, impaired service, and the network operator or the genie bit is going to have to define what they consider a degraded operation.
And as things evolve, I think you'll get some rough consensus on what each of those three buckets means. All right. Some discussion about the progress we've had talking to people. So our approach here coming into this discussion has been to take our straw man version of what you just saw, the document that was based on, and work especially with the control frameworks to get their input. In addition to that, working with some projects that we already know with our GlobalNOC hats on, and then other sorts of related stakeholders, like talking to Steve about some of the security implications of all this data sharing, and talking to the Personar people about the part I'll get to at the end, which is more about a good way to exchange data and format data. Coming in, we expected a high degree of variability in what we'd hear from the projects in terms of capabilities and methods they'd like for sharing, and met our expectations there. And our approach is not to put a bunch of work onto the projects that we're getting data from, to really start off by finding out what's already out there, what data all these projects are already gathering, how we can get to that data as it is, and start collecting from that, and then build up from that. So I'll just go over some of the conversations we've had. So we talked, obviously, to NLR and Internet 2. Access is already in place here for plenty of operational data, way more than you'd ever need for this, which we have access to as the NOCs for these networks. But we did talk specifically with them to get agreement to share the data. We have this view that the data we collect as a NOC for a network is the
the intellectual property of that network. So it's important for us to talk to NLR and Internet 2 and get their agreement to share what we know as the NLR and Internet 2 NOCs with what we will know as the GMOC. So they both have agreement there. So as soon as those pieces are being actively used, we'll have all of the information that we're interested in about those pieces. We also we've made good progress with the Planet Lab cluster. This was discussed on a Planet Lab cluster call, and there was pretty good consensus on that call that a good starting place would be to talk to Planet Lab Central, figure out what the capabilities are for getting the data that we want out of that about all of the projects within that cluster and moving from there. So we visited Princeton, discussed sort of one by one, went through our list of all those minimum requirements that I talked about and said, how would we provide this? How could we get this from Planet Lab? As a result of that, we're actually actively sharing almost all of that data now with Planet Lab Central with a couple of caveats. We're not getting some of the topology information because that's not as relevant to the Planet Lab project itself. There's not very much network topology there. And we're also not getting information about the rest of the participants in that cluster through that method, just about the Planet Lab project itself. A brief mention here for Max. So we have an existing relationship with Max. Max has already a lot of capabilities for operational data for Dragon and Max itself that we could get access to. So we're working with them to start gathering that data directly from them. What makes this interesting is that Max is part of the Planet Lab cluster. So for us, it makes a good test case for us to talk directly to Max and talk to Planet Lab and look at the data we get about the Max project through both those paths and compare the two, which gives us a good idea for how to move forward in some of these other projects. Other clusters, discussions underway. I don't need to get into a lot of detail here. We've got a lot of data being passed back and forth at detailed levels from various projects. But obviously, we have to go through them one by one and in some ways repeat what we did with Planet Lab and figure out what the capabilities are there. Let me skip this. Yeah. I will make a real quick introduction here. So there are two documents out there that if you're interested, you can look at. One describes our internal data format, how once we're getting this data, what format we're going to put it in, and one which describes the data exchange, which is a starting point for how we might, in a more formal way, start to exchange data among Genie projects and between Genie and other networks. What's that? And I guess I will skip the shout out to Persona for now, which has relevance to data sharing. It might be a good potential way for us to deal with this format question and the data sharing question, something that already exists so we can avoid reinventing the wheel, maybe. So that's it. Any comments?
This is more in the form of a question.
Yeah.
When one starts talking about data exchange and data formats, I think, and maybe I'm just misunderstanding, but I think there's actually a harder problem in there, which is that if you're talking about different networks that are running their own tools and so forth, they're collecting data. Let's take packet traces. They collect packet traces, mm-hmm. but they may, in fact, use different tools than you, and therefore that not only the data format, but the actual type information or class information or whatever kind of language you're using for describing this stuff actually may be somewhat different. And this gets back to a thing that Larry mentioned yesterday with their resource records. I've forgotten what they're called. I'm showing my lack of involvement here. But there's a question not only of how do you translate an integer into an integer in a different domain, but how do you match that type, that meta information in some sense? What is this thing? If it's a packet trace, Which fields does it have, and would, yes. You know, how do those map from one to another, or do they? They may not.
They may
in
not,
fact,
right.
The reconciliation may not be perfect.
Yeah.
Exactly. So there's a sort of a meta level question of how do you do that reconciliation
yeah.
across
how,
those.
How panels. Well does it translate? And yeah. you know, our, I guess our
Are
approach.
You thinking about that?
Our approach right now is to get whatever they have in whatever format they have it. And as we evolve, I think there will be some areas that are much easier to make common than others.
Yeah.
And so we're working on
well, so I think there's another issue which brings up some of the stuff that I was talking about earlier, which is that there may be, I mean, right now, if you're talking about the clusters, yeah, they're going to be full-fledged players in Gini and probably have to share data completely. But as resources start coming in that are perhaps networks in other environments where mm-hmm. they are not going to give you all their data. They are, you know, they may be willing to answer some questions for you, but they're not going to give it to you.
Yeah.
It becomes a more complicated set of problems.
And, you know, I don't think we'll ever get to the point where we don't have clouds on the map, right?
Yeah.
Some things that we just aren't allowed to see into or aren't maybe not relevant to see into. And I think...
Well, I think the problem is that from the network management point of view, when you start composing these things where you don't have complete control, I mean, you know, some of this stuff is going to be going over the internet, and those ISPs out there are not going to tell you everything, no
right.
matter how much you wish they would. But the question is, how does one find kind of the middle ground and build the incentives so that they'll tell you something? You know, if somebody's trying to run an experiment and it's not working right, and there's, you know, you can narrow it down to, oh, it's going across this ISP. Could they at least, you know, give you some hint as to what's going on, or be willing to solve a problem if you, you know, if mm-hmm. some automated system actually comes at them and says, "We've really narrowed the problem to your space."
Yeah.
So there's a question of the extent to which there are incentives for them to actually be willing to share, because for the most part now they aren't.
Yeah.
They just
yeah.
say no.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I ask network managers what information they are willing to tell anybody, and they say nothing.
None of your business.
Because we do not understand enough about what risk we're putting ourselves at by answering
yeah.
those questions.
Yep. And I don't really have the incentive answer. But, it, you know, it's something that happens in, with changing hats again, it's something that happens in production networking,
yeah.
too. You know, and that's part
Absolutely.
Of the impetus behind Personar, and part of the challenge with Personar is that, you know, how do you incent networks to share information about themselves?
Well, and there's two parts of it. One is the incentives, and the other is negotiating what it actually is that they're going to share,
yes.
you know, which pieces of information or which abstractions or summaries or whatever it is. Are they, you know,
yeah.
can you find that, you know?
And to some extent, that's an incentive question also, because
yeah.
what you're really doing, half the reason they don't share it is because they don't know, they don't want to put a bunch of effort into figuring out how to.
Yes.
Not even just that they don't want you to see, it's that, you know, they don't want to figure out how to
it
do
doesn't
the
do them any good to right. tell you which ways they're failing.
So making it easier for them to do it and then giving them incentive both
yeah.
sides of that help. So
yep. Great.
I don't know how, but
actually you have to stop. Yeah, the break is starting. So I'm really glad we had a lot of interaction. And so as
no,
a result,
no, that's not yours.
There's
that's,
another presentation
no,
which Mike has
your,
about
yes.
Addressing and routing. We're going to keep going and give that anyway. But if anybody wants to leave, feel free. We won't look at you sideways. But if you're interested in hearing the part about routing and addressing, it'll be limited to the next 15 minutes. And it's also going to be on the web, so you can check it out later and get in touch with Mike directly.
Okay, I'm going to try and do this really fast because it was started out as a longer presentation, and the break is over in 15 minutes, and so I have like 26 slides. So this is an outline. You don't need to see the outline. You'll see the talk. The main motivation for this talk is integration, the I in OMIS. There's two questions. I'm primarily going to talk about how projects connect to one another in this talk. There's also how CF clusters connect to one another, and that'll probably be the next talk, because they're not ready to do that quite yet. There's a concentration on addressing and routing, because people have been asking a lot of questions in those areas. But I'm thinking about integration in a larger context, and Most projects have milestones for integration this summer. So you should be paying attention to this, and I will come back to that later on in the talk. There are three kinds of communications that are happening that will come up in the talk. Project internal talk, connectivity, which can be many different kinds of things. The Gini control plane, how the various Gini components talk to one another, and an experiment data plane that the projects need to set up in order for there to be end-to-end experiments across multiple projects. And I'm trying to be a little bit careful about terminology, except I put one up at the top here where many of my diagrams have a block labeled clearinghouse. You can substitute any common service thing for that. There's also PKI infrastructure, things that aren't part of the substrate things. And I tried to be really careful to use the terms project to talk about project internal stuff, that's Gini-funded DNP projects, the Gini control plane, and things that are part of experiments, which is not the stuff that the people in the projects are doing. I'm not absolutely certain that I got that right everywhere, but I went back over the slides a couple times to try and make sure I got it right. It can be very confusing. Several times in earlier versions of the slide, I just had the phrase control plane, which was sometimes the Gini control plane and sometimes the project control plane. So I hope I caught all of those. So I need a Gini address. Who needs a Gini address? I won't do that joke. So Gini addresses are used for components to talk to clearinghouses, other things in the control plane to talk to the control managers, aggregate managers. Tools have to talk to them. No. This is just what people who are part of Gini might use an address for. If you're setting up tunnels, there's a piece of infrastructure that's really only IP, but you want to simulate an L2 connection, you might set up a tunnel. Tunnels are also going to be used for opt-in users. Those need IP addresses at both ends. And experiments that are running inside Gini but are trying to be a piece of the legacy IP structure might need addresses as well, operations and management. And there used to be a bullet on here that said other. What you need an address for is what determines where you get it, which is what's on the next slide.
Okay, so maybe you're going to get there. So now it looks like you are talking about IP addresses and where do they come from. We punted and we got our own. We got a /24 a CANREN, but...
This is talking about IPv4 addresses. There's some context thing. I probably should have put that slide earlier. Oh, well. Okay. So where you get a routing, where you get an address from really does depend on where you're connected, because in the legacy IP, this is probably, most of you probably know all of this already, but, you know, researchers don't necessarily know the operational network. So routing in the internet is done on a prefix of the IP address. If the place you connect, the address you get, isn't in the prefix that's routed to them, then traffic for that IP address isn't going to come to them, and so you'll never see the data. So for addresses to work, you have to have both ends need a valid prefix that's within the block, a valid address that's within the prefix where they're connected, and both ends have to be advertising routing. That means if you're on a campus IP network, you need a campus IP address. If you're connected to an ISP, you need an address from that ISP. In fact, as it says on the bottom, if you're connected to a whatever, you need to get your address from whatever. It's sort of the general policy, the general way that addressing works today. So Gini addresses. We don't actually have a Gini address block yet, but we're working on that. And I'll say more a little bit later. This is sort of trying to identify things that in the final end, when there really is a genie that's collectively connected, things that would use addresses out of their prefix. And in particular, not all components would want to have a genie prefix because the control plane is outside of genie in some sense. It's just using traditional IP. Now, some of that traditional IP might be carried by Genie equipment, which could be done if care is taken to make sure you have avoid circular dependencies. You don't want the control traffic to a particular component to go through a sliver that's on that component, because then if it fails, you can't talk to it. So to try and make things concrete, I've chosen three, and I'm going to talk about one, maybe two, because we're short on time, and just skip quickly through the other one. Emphasis in my talk is for pedagogical reasons. I'm going to mention some things that are low probability or contingency plans and errors because it's an interesting case to consider, not because they expect that they're going to do that. And these are not complete project descriptions. See the project information if you want. Things that were irrelevant to what I wanted to say have been completely left out. Sometimes they have several options for something and they haven't chosen one yet, and I chose the one that sounded the most interesting for my talk. I don't speak for the projects. I may well be misrepresenting part of what they have. So please don't take anything I say as writ for what the projects are doing. This is for how interconnectivity can work for these cases. And anything that might sound like a criticism of a project isn't really a criticism of that project. They're usually, in fact, the best one on it. If you were at my presentation in Palo Alto, this is my big picture from that. And the three projects I've chosen are in the upper right, lower left, and lower right corners. Of that diagram. The most interesting one I found when I was considering them was Project 1599's Dome, which is intermittently connected mobile nodes. They have Zen processors on buses that are driving around town and sometimes drive past open APs, and therefore they get connectivity. Layer 2 is available in a few locations for them, but primarily everything is Layer 3 connections. They are getting a Layer 2 link into Internet 2 through a regional. We can go on. This is their diagram, which isn't really useful when you're thinking about interconnectivity, because I forgot to put the notes on the right-hand side of this, but their entire interconnectivity is one box in the lower right-hand corner of the diagram. So I scribbled all over it, and we don't need to know the details of what's in a bus, it's just a bus. But we do note, the transparency didn't work. So you can't read the word regional. I inserted a regional between their campus and the internet, and I added other projects that they get connected to and what happens at layers two and layers three. Do we actually have anyone from Dome here? Oh, well. And so you notice one of the big things to notice about the diagram is that the layer 2 graph and the layer 3 graph are not highly correlated, which was one of the reasons for picking them as an example. Their layer 2 connectivity and their layer 3 connectivity is very different. There's pieces of commercial internet that they can't do layer 2 over, and pieces of stuff that they own that they can do layer 2 over. So how do they do integration with the rest of Genie? In their case, their project internal communications is they use the 3G wireless standard IP protocol for internal controls, which talk back to their aggregate manager, and they also carry IP over open APs. The Genie control plane is an AM, is just the aggregate manager, one workstation that sits on their campus network, gets an address from their campus network, and speaks IP to communicate with the rest of the control plane for their the rest of their cluster framework. And in their case, the experiment data plane that they support is primarily layer 3, speaking natively over commercial ISPs, or tunneled if your experiment would need to, you could do a tunnel. Yeah. And they are getting a layer 2 drop through a regional to Internet 2, and they could use tunnels for things that they can't get through that way. Internet scale overlay hosting is a very different project. They have nodes spread out all over the place in Internet 2 POPs. So they're inside the POPs, and this diagram just completely didn't come out on this version. Well, we had three diagrams here that were what their POP stuff. Yeah, well, I did it on OpenOffice and did it to PowerPoint. Yeah, it worked really good last time. And this is it. This was sort of their summary, too. And I've done it for another one we're not even going to talk about. So most projects have milestones. One thing I'll like to say before we quit is I do recommend everybody look at all the other projects that are going on. In the process of looking at these three projects, I found things in one project that another project could really use. I pass that information on, but if I haven't looked at your project, I haven't done that for you. And you may well find stuff. And we are working on getting a direct block of Genie addresses. And if you have any good contacts in Aaron that could help us with a transfer that we need to do, please get in touch with us. Helping make that smooth would be good. And otherwise, we're done.
Okay. The cluster out briefs are starting now. So thanks for staying to hear this. If you want to look at the slides, the PDF versions do show the transparency screen.
Yeah, the PDF version does look better than that.
And please ask questions and follow up with us in person or phone or internet with anything that comes up. Thanks very much.